Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the People's School for Marxism-Leninism Studies. Tonight is January 9th, 2024. Our class tonight will be continuing our series on imperialism. This will be part four, the rise of American unipolarity, and we'll be covering the periods of 1991 to 2005.
Yeah, I just wanted to offer a correction. This isn't the fourth part in this series. The history of U.S. imperialism series has been going on since May of last year. I think this has to be probably the seventh or eighth part. Just as a little background, just so that we're caught up. The first one was on origins. That went over development of American capitalism, the Spanish-American War, stuff around that time. Then we went over World War I and World War II. We looked at the dawn of the Cold War and how things changed during that era. We went through the height of the Cold War and got to the end of the Cold War with the counter-revolution in the USSR. Now we're picking up on the rise of American unipolarity post-counter-revolution. Some of those classes you can already find uploaded on YouTube, and I think all of them you can find the PowerPoints for on our website. And with that, if we don't have any comments from Angelo, we can go ahead and get started. So this is the history of U.S. imperialism, rise of American unipolarity. What we're going to be learning today is about the 1991 counter-revolution in the USSR and how it began a period of American unipolarity in world politics. We're also going to learn about the start of the global war on terrorism after the attacks on September 11th, as well as other U.S. military interventions in the 1990s, like the Gulf War, the war in Somalia, and Yugoslavia, etc. And we're also going to be going over some domestic and trade issues during this period, including NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, Patriot Act, and more.
Yeah, so we start with, in 1991, Clinton, Yeltsin, NATO, and transnational corporations. So in this is the aftermath of the Soviet counter-revolution. You can see a little picture there. A lot of this first page comes from North Star Compass, the Canadian organization. In 1991, when the final chapters of tragedy of that took place and murderous deadly assaults on the people of the Soviet Union began, President Boris, using force and violence, suppressed the democratically elected parliament and provincial councils, monopolized the media, killed over 1,000 people, and arrested thousands more, all in the name of saving democracy. U.S. political consultants operated in strict secrecy, lest they be seen as interfering in Russian affairs, which indeed they were. They advised Yeltsin against making extended speeches and urged more sound bites and photo opportunities. They pointed to the issues and images he could exploit and ones he should avoid. Now, this is coming from Michael Prentice's Reds and Black Shirts. Since the overthrow of communism, free market right-wing forces in the various Eastern European countries enjoyed significant financial and organizational assistance from U.S. finance agencies, such as the National Endowment for Democracy, the AFL-CIO's Free Trade Union Institute, that's a group intimately linked to the CIA, and the Free Congress Foundation, an organization with an anti-communist and conservative religious ideology. In addition, the material and political aid that the Soviet Union, Bulgaria, and East Germany gave to the Third World liberation struggles is no longer forthcoming. Instead, ex-communist countries now join in imperialist wars, as with Desert Storm in 1991 and U.S.-directed interventions, as in Somalia in 1993, further strengthening the interventionist powers of the most powerful imperialist states. And in 1991, the European Community, with U.S. involvement, organized a conference on Yugoslavia that called for sovereign and independent republics. An IMF imposed austerity brought sharply declining living standards to Yugoslavia, which in turn corroded the rights and securities that people in that country had come to rely upon. As the economy reeled from the neoliberal shock therapy, revenues to the central government declined while tax burdens rose. And that came from Against Empire by Michael Prenti. And now we'll talk about the Yugoslavian War, which if you look there on the right, that was up to January of 1991, when Yugoslavia was the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. You could see the different parts there. Now this is going to all break up, unfortunately. So on the 25th of June, 1991, the declarations of independence of Slovenia and Croatia effectively ended the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia's existence. By April 1992, the further declarations of independence by two other republics, Macedonia, as well as Bosnia and Herzegovina, left only Serbia and Montenegro within the Federation. And these two remaining republics declared the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia on April 27, 1992. So after the overthrow of communism throughout Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia remained the only nation in that region that would not voluntarily discard what remained of its socialism and install an unalloyed free market system. It also proudly had no interest in joining NATO. The U.S. goal had been to transform the FRY into a third world region. A cluster of weak right-wing principalities with the following characteristics, and here's what really the neoliberalism was trying to push. Incapable of charting an independent course of self-development. Natural resources completely accessible to transnational corporate exploitation, including the enormous mineral wealth in Kosovo. An impoverished but literate and skilled population working at subsistence wages and cheap labor pool that will help depress wages in Western Europe and elsewhere. Dismantled petroleum, engineering, mining, fertilizer, pharmaceutical, construction, automotive, and agricultural industries, so they no longer offer competition against Western producers. And this divide and conquer strategy of breaking up was finally ended at a ceasefire. The Dayton Accords was brokered by Western powers in November 1995 with terms that ensured Western suzerainty over the thoroughly partitioned, basically sovereignty, over a thoroughly partitioned Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Herzegovina. All this time, U.S. leaders acted as if any attempt by the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia to resist secession was a violation of national self-determination and international law. Command and control of the world rests increasingly with corporations. So now we're talking about the current tense here. And the organizations that support them, such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and NATO, with the assault on Yugoslavia, Clinton and NATO declared war upon democratic sovereignty and the right of citizens to have any say about policies that are carried out in their name. And that also was taken from North Star Compass, that picture of Bill Clinton with the swastika. Attack on Kosovo and other bombing. So this once again, back in Yugoslavia, or the former Yugoslavian Republic, from March 24 to June 10th, 1999, U.S. military forces, coordination with a number of other NATO powers, launched round-the-dock aerial attacks against Yugoslavia, dropping 20,000 tons of bombs and killing upwards of 3,000 women, children, and men. And all this was done out of humanitarian concern for Albanians in Kosovo, or so we were asked to believe. in the span of a few weeks. And this is coming from, it's a really good book on this topic, from How to Kill a Nation by Michael Prentice. President Clinton bombed four countries at that time, Sudan, Afghanistan, Iraq, repeatedly, and Yugoslavia, massively, and at the same time. Sorry, at the same time, the U.S. national security state was involved in proxy wars in Angola, Mexico, Colombia, and East Timor. I believe that's near Indonesia, or in Indonesia, among other places. U.S. forces were deployed across the globe at some 300 major overseas bases, all in the name of peace, democracy, national security, and humanitarianism. And so if you look at that picture in the middle there, you could see that's giving the portion of the populations that had to leave, you know, kind of as refugees. We could see similar stuff that's happening in Gaza. But if you look at that 90%, that's the area of Kosovo. And so it's a big population there that had to leave. Hopefully we'll have this whole thing as an entire topic, because there's a lot of details that we skipped over.
We will now break for a round of discussions.
I'm one of the few people on this phone call who lived during that period and was active in fighting it. Most of the others here are too young. So let me just say that Yugoslavia was the last country in Europe, the last one that had some kind of socialism. The United States had to get rid of all of them. So they got rid of all the ones in 1991 first, in the counter-revolution, including the Soviet Union. Then they went into after Yugoslavia. And it was all done by the liberals. His name was Clinton, and his wife, Hillary, the same woman who ran for office recently in the last election. These liberal anti-communists are really a danger to the people in this country. And it's unfortunate that some people on the left, like the old CPUSA, still supports the Democrats. The same Democrats, by the way, who are now attacking Gaza by giving them aid to the Israelis. The same Democrats who are now in the Ukraine, started that whole thing in the Ukraine. So this should be the end of the Democratic Party for anybody who's decent. Thank you.
One of the things that was mentioned earlier was how in those countries, the United States pumped money in and things like that. And it goes to like the Vietnam War. We have to destroy the village to save the village. And so all those countries were destroyed. I saw a recent poll of all the former socialist countries in Europe of how many people wished it was still socialism. And it was very high. Hungary had the highest. That's all I have to say for now.
Thank you. I wanted to touch on one of the things from the earliest slides. Something that was mentioned was the free, what was it? Free Trade Union Institute. It was mentioned in one of the earlier Parenti slides. This was an organization that was used. That was the organization that was specifically used in Poland in the 80s to foment the fake labor uprising called Solidarity or Solidarnosc. That specific institute doesn't exist anymore. It merged with several others, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, which focused on Latin America, the Asian American Free Labor Institute that focused on Asia, and the African American Labor Institute that focused on Africa, and the Free Trade Union Institute mainly focused on Europe. And they merged in 1997 to form what is now known as the Solidarity Center. And they are still very active in U.S. imperialism now. They are a core grantee from the NED, which we all know is a CIA cutout. And the Solidarity Center was highly involved in the 2014 Maidan coup that overthrew the democratically elected government.
Yeah, I know, and I've heard that Tito was able to keep Yugoslavia together, and forgive me if this is too specific for this class, but are there any specific details apart from, I guess, trying to abolish racism, that he was able to keep Yugoslavia together, and as soon as he died, everything went to hell. Is there a little bit of concrete ideas how he's able to keep Yugoslavia together? Thank you.
I'm not too deep on Tito myself, but I do recommend the book that was cited throughout, portion, To Kill a Nation by Michael Parenti. It's a fantastic book on that. And I believe, I forget the author, but I think there's another one called Killing Hope or something. There was another Yugoslavia book or...
Yep, Killing Hope by William Blum, B-L-U-M. It's a very good book.
Yeah, I was just wondering a bit more about the National Endowment for Democracy, because I feel like it's ringing a couple bells in my head as far as other things that I've heard about from them, but I can't quite put my finger on it. If anybody else wanted to chime in on other things that they had their fingers in, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Is this specifically on the NED or just like the three-letter agencies that have their hands in the NED?
I feel like I've heard the National Endowment for Democracy. Just that. Whatever we got.
Well, I do know that they have been involved with giving some of the Hong Kong activists money before protests there broke out. And a lot of these other color revolutions, they've been very involved and interested in some of the actors behind those.
Yes, National Endowment for Democracy, you might know them because they are behind Radio Free Asia, and formerly they're behind Radio Free Europe back in the Cold War. Radio Free Asia is one of the main kind of anti-communist propaganda outlets around today. They're basically what started the whole Uyghur genocide thing. It's Radio Free Asia, actually, and a lot of that. DPRK, too, that's from them.
Yeah, so with the NED back in the 70s and 80s, they did act a lot more covertly. But as of recent, they've shown their face a lot more, that they are directly funded by the CIA. For example, the Cuban protest that took place in, I think, 2021, all of the so-called leaders of this protest had come out and said, we are paid by the NED. So, you know, yeah.
Yeah, just two brief things real quick to take note of. The first thing is, one of the things that gets forgotten about the war in Yugoslavia is that the United States actually bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in May of 1999 and killed three Chinese state media people there. And even though Clinton like issued a verbal apology for it, the United States in general never did. They said that it was an accident and nobody was ever held accountable for it. So that's just an interesting turn of events there. The other thing I wanted to add is, adding on to sort of the way that Democrats support these wars, Bernie Sanders back in the 1990s, you know, everybody thinks of him as some big progressive, but he actually went in front of the Senate and argued for the bombing of Kosovo. And of course, now he won't even support a ceasefire. So it just goes to show you that even these supposed trustable Democrats like Bernie Sanders aren't really anti-war, anti-imperialist. They just serve the state in a different way.
Also, keep in mind about the Yugoslavia conflict that this was the first time U.S. forces started using depleted uranium weapons in that area. And even to this day, there are places that are contaminated by those. And we're now seeing these same weapons being used in Ukraine as they were also used in Iraq and other places.
I'd like to just also mention that the genesis of this imperialist, anti-socialist, anti-communist project was the Truman Doctrine. You know, that us being the imperial core began, you know, with this extremely violent imperialist, again, another Democrat as well. And it's important to mention, as any socialist in the room, that our duty is to, you know, build up socialism within this imperial core nation in order to break the chokehold of imperialism and global anti-communism.
One of the downfalls of Yugoslavia and Tito was, Tito was a market socialist, and there were a lot of co-ops in the country, and when sort of a new bourgeoisie kind of developed through the process, and those co-ops became corporations eventually. And you can imagine that's why it led to the infighting, because they were all they it created the national bourgeoisie in each country. Yugoslavia wasn't structured in the same way the Soviet Union was.
Yeah, may as well just throw in 2 cents and call out our current president, Joe Biden, who was a ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee during the whole Yugoslavia snafu in the 90s. Some people think Clinton was actually more inclined to take a hands-off approach, but Biden was one of the most vociferous proponents for bombing Yugoslavia, even advocating for a Dresden-style occupation, bombing bridges on the Drina, et cetera, et cetera. You can see some of the videos of him on the Senate floor on YouTube. That's all. Thanks.
I just want to emphasize that, you know, this was NATO. They are the Fourth Reich, and they were supporting straight up fascists, the Croatian fascists from World War II, the Ustashi. They were very brutal, arguably worse than what the Nazis did. And actually, Michael Prince references another member that we've had here, Barry Lutuce, who, you know, talked about how Serbia was really demonized. Like, it's war is complicated, but the way the Serbs were demonized by the Western media were was just straight up just lies, and very brutal what happened to them. That's all.
Yes, Barry Lutuce, Professor Barry Lutuce, that was just mentioned, he heads a group called Jasenovic Research Institute, JRI. You should look it up on the websites. They are a concentration camp that was run by the Ustashi, the Croatians, in Yugoslavia in World War II. And they're the ones that took control of Croatia when it was separated from Yugoslavia in 1991. So the United States has been working with fascists for a while now, from 91 on, actual fascists. And you do know in the Ukraine, they're supporting the fascist government and all the fact, the Azov battalion and all of them. So the United States, basically through the Democrats, are now supporting fascist formations throughout the world. Remember that. I'm registered as a Democrat, by the way. And I'm a lifelong Democrat. And this is not the Democratic Party of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's a totally opposite party of that. Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to say something regarding some of the excerpts from Michael Parenti that we read. So basically, Parenti had a relationship, a friendship with Bernie Sanders, believe it or not. And it was actually over the Clinton administration and the area where the bombing of NATO bombing of Yugoslavia that basically is what caused Parenti to cut his relations off with Bernie entirely. Now that we look back at the period, we realize that Parenti was absolutely correct, where Bernie supported the bombing and Parenti was against the bombing. And Parenti was correct in his analysis. And Bernie was wrong. And Bernie has been terrible on foreign policy for a very long time, too. So it's just indication that, you know, basically, I mean, yeah, the Social Democrats are imperialists, too.
It's important to note, especially during this period on the ideological front, we suffered a lot of setbacks, too. It's in this period. And this you can view this for, I guess, as a byproduct of the collapse of the socialist world, because we had a socialist world, comrades. Half the world was socialist, either that of the Marxist-Leninist variety of or some other type of socialist, either be it Ba'athist, Arab nationalist, or some local variety. As a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Marxist-Leninist core to the socialist world, we basically earn a place, and this has actually continued to the present day, where we as communists, our first priority is the anti-imperialist movement. It's against NATO. It's against fascism. That is the first priority. And in doing this, we have to align ourselves with non-socialist forces. I think a primary example of this is the struggle in Palestine. In Palestine and in the occupied regions, the communists, which are the Palestinian Communist Party, that's the one that we're closest to, and the other groups such as the PFLP, the PLO, and the DFLP, the communists, they're aligned with the Khomeinists. They're aligned with Hezbollah, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and a lot of other groups. In Syria, both communist parties, the Syrian Communist Party and the Syrian Communist Party, I don't know the acronym, but they're in a popular front with the Baathists, with Assad. All across the world, communists are part of a popular fronts that are against imperialism. And it used to be that we would lead these popular fronts, but unfortunately, as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the socialist world, we've kind of backslid from that. And the only way we're going to get back to a socialist world is, you know, having more socialist powers emerge following Marxism in the 21st century. That's the only way we're going to get back our geopolitical significance.
Yeah, just since we're discussing the Yugoslavia thing briefly, there's a really good documentary called The Weight of Chains. There are actually three of them. The first two, I think, do very well to describe how it was that imperialist forces moved in, privatized the markets, and overtook the sovereignty of Yugoslavia. Michael Parenti is heavily featured in it. I also believe our comrade Barry Latucci is also in it, if I remember correctly. So I would recommend that one. I'll drop a link in the chat to that. And then I just also wanted to mention that the United States and the UK have started bombing Yemen and the Houthis in response to their blockade over the Red Sea tonight. So that was all I was going to mention. Thanks.
Yes, indeed. So my section's a couple shorter slides, but no less interesting. So this is U.S. imperialism and the split in the global communist movement. So at the counter-revolution in 1991, the Soviet Union had been a bulwark against U.S. imperialism expansion and also United World Communist Parties. Concerning the United States, though, with the counter-revolution, there was an immediate split in the Communist Party USA between party leadership with Gus Hall and right revisionists that formed the Committee of Correspondence in 1991. You'll kind of see their logo right there in the middle of the screen. They changed their name to the Committees of Correspondence of Democratic Socialism in 2003, and apparently they're somewhat still around. The group had argued for a rejection of Marxism-Leninism and adopt a democratic socialist orientation. This new group was led by notable people like Angela Davis, Pete Seeger, Gil Green, and others. And so the split from the CPUSA of the Committees of Correspondence took a good portion of the membership from the party, and they also, where have we heard this before, absconded with property of the party in San Francisco and in other holdings. There's also in the country a realignment of groups towards ultra-left tendencies like Trotskyism, New Left, Maoism, as well as towards right opportunism like social democracy. Or as Jarvis Tyner called it in a 1994 article, a jettison of Marxism-Leninism in favor of an amalgam of every ideological trend on the left. In a New York Times interview on December 21st, 1994, Gus Hall called the group a thoroughly petty bourgeoisie phenomenon made up of those experiencing ideological collapse, political dishonesty, and simple greed. With the split, former suppressed fascist movements began to reappear. Per articles in North Star Compass magazine from 93 and a couple years afterwards, the UPAOUN, which had been suppressed in Ukraine, reappeared and demanded recognition by then President Kravchuk of Ukraine as patriots. And in areas of former sister republics of the USSR, Russian speakers were under discrimination, terror, and were almost treated as second-class citizens. And experts from the UN stated that per rules of discrimination in the United States, they saw no discrimination in these areas against Russian speakers. Former Warsaw Pact countries areas saw communist parties dissolved, banned, and some were even put on trial for trumped up charges. One of the most egregious examples of this was in the former German Democratic Republic. That was a complete annexation by the Federal Republic of Germany. And even though they had talked about not putting anyone from former leaderships on trial, I believe like seven or so former party members were put on trial and some jailed for just charges of being heads of state. And then I thought this was a really interesting article per a professor Vladimir Harasimchuk out of a university in Ukraine in 1993. This is per North Star Compass. But at this time, thanks to the clique of Gorbachev, Yeltsin, Shevardnadze, Yakovlev, and company, the attack was successful. This is referring to the 1991 counter-revolution. In formulating the scheme and the scenario undermining the USSR and the attacks on communism all over the world, Alan Dulles was a chief architect, and in our years, it was Carter, Reagan, and Bush. These planners of subversion were, of course, not so naive to believe that after the counter-revolution and the dismemberment of the USSR, the communist movement would just roll over and play dead. And it would be naive for us to think that after the USSR collapse, that these provocateurs of imperialism would just sit back with folded arms and wait for the death of communist ideology. The US imperialists knew that with their help and financing, they'd be able to find the internal separatists and provocateurs who, masquerading under communist phraseology and red banners, would be able to hide themselves in different communist socialist parties and movements. Therefore, in looking at different parties and their leaders, it is necessary to be very careful and realistic, not looking at their slogans, but looking and analyzing their actions. The insertion of differences in the communist movement is an enormous help to capitalism. And then lastly, Diego Rivera actually did a mural that I thought was quite interesting. It was called Glorious Victory. This depicts the 1954 Guatemalan overthrow. But prominently in the center there, you can see Alan and John Foster Dulles, the Dulles brothers, who were basically the people behind the CIA, some of the largest multinational corporations in America, and with them celebrating, were pretty much the foremost agents of U.S. imperialism in the world. Okay, and with that, we'll break for another round of discussions.
Yeah, a couple things. First, from the first set of slides, I want to just respond to something I said on how, you know, these wars are sold to us. We can't forget that Michael Parenti, who a couple of sub-slides were quoting some of his works earlier, wrote the book Inventing Reality in the 80s. Noam Chomsky, who wrote a far less, you know, well-written version of that book on how the media sold us these wars, himself backed the Yugoslavian war and was basically acted as, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on that, but and then on this slide, I just wanted to note on the they saw none in regards to discrimination against Russian speakers. They said the same thing about the current Ukrainian state with regards to their laws banning the Russian language and the attacks on the Roma people in Ukraine. And I just think it's not a coincidence that someone like Alan Dulles was involved in these operations, former director of the CIA, and largely believed to be involved in the Kennedy assassination as well.
Thank you, comrades. If anyone wants some further reading on Alan Dulles, I do recommend The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. That is a fantastic book.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about how I don't think it's a coincidence that there was this split in the American communist movement following the counter-revolution. The counter-revolution wasn't just something that happened in the Soviet Union. The counter-revolution was something that happened in the world communist movement. It was in the Soviet Union, it was in Germany, it was throughout Eastern Europe. It had effects even in Asia and other regions, Africa, but it had an effect here on the American communist movement as well. And so when you see, you know, these leftists in the United States now that wouldn't touch the Soviet Union with a 10-stick pole, you know why.
On that little Gus Hall quote that was like three or four slides back where it said, this group is yada, yada, yada. I don't remember it, obviously, but was he referencing, was the group that he was referencing, was that just the committees of correspondence, or was he talking about like the CPUSA in general?
So that quote was taken from an interview someone did with him at, I believe it was the 75th anniversary of the CPUSA at their headquarters, and he was referring to the Committee of Correspondence with that quote there, and there's also a detail where they were involved in a lawsuit with them at the time for absconding with property in San Francisco as well as other assets, but that was his direct quote as quoted in the interview about them.
Yeah, this is a great class, but I wanted to bring up a few things. So the first thing I wanted to bring up is that age-old quote of follow the money. Like, we have to see that these movements, as they're forming, or not forming, but reforming after, you know, being under Soviet rule and the Eastern Bloc and everything, follow the money. Where are they getting their funding from to suddenly become million-member organizations and all of these things? Like, in Poland, for example, the Solidarity Group was supported by the Catholic Church. And as we know, Poland is a very Catholic country. So it's like, you know, look at the money that they're getting from them. We have to look at this connection with Yugoslavia. You know, we also have to look at the fact that the U.S., its government and its imperialist agents, they are master dialecticians as well. They understood to stoke ethnic tensions. They understood to support these right-wing fringe groups, all of these things. We cannot look at them and say, oh, they're stupid and naive. They're some of the smartest people, you know, walking on this earth, but we just have to be aware of it. That's all.
Thank you, comrade. I was just curious about the split that formed in the CPUSA in 94. Were these like pre-existing schisms that were deepened by the dissolution of the USSR, or was it just kind of an echo of it? Is it something that the party could have safeguarded against? Those are kind of the questions that come to my mind. It is like,
so yes. Okay, so think back to Glasnost and Perestroika, especially with what Gorbachev had put out, especially with Perestroika of the more openness and whatnot. There was already a schism forming within the party because of that. And it all kind of came to a head at the 25th Congress, and I believe it was 1992 when all that happened. But that had been kind of a thing that had been brewing ever since that era.
No, I just wanted to say that in Canada, we also had not necessarily a split, but our party was devastated after the 91 Perestroika stuff. That's it.
Yeah, so y'all can look this up on y'all's own time, but there was something called Operation Yellowbird, where the CIA in 1989 worked with MI6 and the Triads, which is a trans-international Chinese mafia, basically. And they instigated the stuff in Tiananmen Square, and they helped them escape. There's like records of them. They worked with the Triads to help them escape through Hong Kong. But Operation Yellowbird lasted until 1997 because the ultimate goal was to keep Hong Kong from being transferred to China. So they instigated protests back then. I'm sure in a few years we'll find out that in the Hong Kong riots they had recently, I'm sure the NED was involved. You know the NED was involved. You can find traces of them, but there are yeah, like some, I forgot who said it, but you follow the money. You just, you know, follow the money. They worked with the Triads. The CIA worked with the mafia in the past to take over certain areas in Latin America, especially in Cuba. They worked with the mafia. So they will work with literal
60 seconds. Criminals.
Murder. The capitalists will work with murdering criminals to stamp out a movement.
I think Lenin said that war often exposes like the rotten aspects of the party. And He makes an analogy to like there's no point in trying to reconcile what has already been rotten. And I guess the point he's trying to make is that these, I guess, schisms form over time. And during the peaceful times, they start to form, and it's only when events like war or counter-revolution occur that those splits are, I guess, revealed.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you that I was very active in that period. It was my club on Staten Island that coined the phrase ideological fight back. You all should recognize what that is now. But that was the term we used, that we were ideologically on the offensive against revisionism and anti-communism. And that was used at my club in Staten Island, my party club, Communist Party USA Club. And eventually, it was taken over by the PC USA as their ideological magazine, which now is called the Communist. Shevardnadze, that was his name, by the way, was pronounced that way. Shevardnadze, that's what we called him in North Star Compass. That was the guy from Georgia. So each of the republics of the former Soviet Union had their own traitors. They all came out. So this was, and it's interesting because in the CPUSA, the general secretary had a different view. So he had tapes that we presented at all our clubs talking about the extremists that are using the word perestroika and glasnost. And he concentrated and put the magnifying glass on them. But the rest of the party was supporting, and the bourgeoisie, the New York Times, was supporting these so-called liberals. These so-called liberals. I want you to know that Angela Davis, Herbert Aptheker, people who should have known better, collapsed.
My question is, what percentage of the party left during the committees of correspondence split?
50%. In New
Okay.
York, we lost 50%. We went
Wow.
from a party of 5,000 to a 1,500,
Was there a lot
2,000
of
the most.
drama and lobbying on the cell level between people that felt
No,
differently?
that didn't happen. What happened is that people just got involved with the committees of correspondence, which he was mentioned in the slide. And let me tell you, comrades, the what how it works. The people that we were our brothers on Monday, on Tuesday, they were not our brothers anymore. When I used to walk on the street and see people that I would hug and kiss in the teachers' movement, now they're on the other side. We shun them. We shun them. I lived through this. We shun them. They were traitors. Remember the worst place in hell. Who was it kept for? The traitor. If you know anything about the Ninth Circle, by I forgot the name of the guy now, the Italian medieval person at the time, but the Ninth Circle is the place in hell that's was saved for the traitor. They're the worst. Thank you.
How much of US foreign policy and unipolarity do you think is predicated on keeping these big corporations in business in one form or another?
I would personally say it's a good chunk of that, since it's all these large corporations that lobbied the government throughout the Cold War and then underwrote a lot of different legislation. And then you had senior government officials that would go be either lobbyists or sit on the board of these companies afterwards. And then it was, and then you had all the investors behind these companies as well that, got their money back and then wanted to expand their markets and reach and profits to elsewhere. But I'd say it's a good bit of
It's not just the maintenance of like the existing King of the Hill structure for these monopolists and these oligarchs. It's also the destruction of any competition within like the second or third world. So, for example, people had this idea when we went into Iraq that we were just going in there to steal the oil. Yeah, we did. I mean, Halliburton and the oil companies, we basically looted the place. But it was less going into Iraq to steal the oil, but more to wipe Iraq off the oil, international oil markets, to wipe a socialist country off of the international oil markets so they couldn't sell their oil and challenge the existing four major super oil companies such as BP, Shell, Chevron, and ExxonMobil. So again, imperialism isn't just imperialism isn't an adjective. It isn't a way, it isn't a describing word. It's a noun. It describes an existing system of capitalism, which is the carving up of the world and by these, you know, and by various cartels, syndicates, and executives. That's the way Lenin defined it. And it still applies today, regardless of what, you know, synthetic leftists and the new left like to define as imperialism.
All right. And this is my section that I did. It's probably the most eventful part in this whole history of U.S. imperialism section, other than maybe World War II. The U.S. and the Middle East, the Gulf War, September 11th, and the War on Terror. So we start off with the Gulf War, with Operation Desert Storm. In 1990 and 91, there was the Gulf War, which was a conflict triggered by Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in August 1990, which was due to Kuwait increasing their oil output after the Iran-Iraq War at the behest of Saudi Arabia. An international coalition led by the United States responded with a military intervention to stop the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Operation Desert Storm was launched in January of 1991, which saw a swift and overwhelming coalition victory, utilizing airstrikes and ground forces, and committing the Highway of Death war crime. The war concluded with Iraq's expulsion from Kuwait, and Saddam Hussein remained in power, setting the stage for the subsequent geopolitical tensions in the region. The war was heavily propagandized, and the footage shown to the American public was of highly advanced military equipment delivering blows to Iraqi forces, and was not the same as the night-to-night ugly but real footage of the Vietnam War. I've heard it described before as the start of the video game era in terms of like warfare, where everything is shown to be all glossy and cool, but you know, actually war is happening and civilians are dying. In the 1990s in the Middle East, you know, outside of the Iraq War, we have setting the stage. While the 1990-91 Gulf War was the most flagrant U.S. military intervention in the 1990s, there were several more cases of intervention and interference in the region in the decade that would set the stage for what was to come in the next decade. So we had Iraqi no-fly zones from 1991 to 2003. In the aftermath of the Gulf War, the United States and its allies established no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq to protect Kurdish and Shiite populations from potential reprisals by Iraq. These zones were maintained through regular military patrols and occasional airstrikes. And you can see the map of that no-fly zone over on the side. Then there was Operation Desert Fox in 1998, which was a four-day bombing campaign that targeted Iraq's weapons of mass destruction facilities, which I think was chemical, if anything, in response to Iraq's lack of cooperation with UN weapons inspectors. It marked a significant escalation of tensions between U.S. and Iraq. We had continued U.S. support, military support for Zionist Israel, which continued to kill and displace Palestinians following the first Intifada and into the second. This was a significant driver of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist activity in the Middle East. We had Operation Restore Hope in 1992 to 93 as well, which was when U.S. and U.N. forces dispatched soldiers to Somalia to counter the Somali National Alliance. And at the end of the day, only 18 U.S. soldiers died, but hundreds of Somali militiamen and civilians were killed. And that's what where the famous Black Hawk Down scenario was. And you can see one of the Black Hawk helicopters flying over Mogadishu in the 1990s. Then September 11th, 2001, blowback. Of course, on September 11th, 2001, as we all know, since we're Americans, we're very intimately familiar with this, the United States was attacked by Al-Qaeda in a series of coordinated terrorist attacks on premier symbols of U.S. imperialism, including the World Trade Center in New York City and the Pentagon just outside of Washington, D.C. It was the first time the U.S. was attacked like in this scale since 1941. Over 2,900 people died that day, and the death toll has since been surpassed, or has since surpassed 3,000 due to the government neglect of first responders and others affected by the collapse of the two World Trade Center towers. Shortly after Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility, though not before Donald Rumsfeld was trying to find any evidence of Iraqi involvement, just to note. And in a letter in 2002, Al-Qaeda stated that, "Why are we fighting and opposing you? The answer is very simple. Because you attacked us and continue to attack us. A, you attacked us in Palestine. B, you attacked us in Somalia. You supported the Russian atrocities against us in Chechnya, the Indian oppression against us in Kashmir, and the Israeli aggression against us in Lebanon. And C, under your supervision, consent, and orders, the governments of our countries, which act as your agents, attack us on a daily basis." Then the global war on terror starts. Acting out. Following 9/11, the American public was inundated by hawkish pro-war and nationalistic rhetoric, a false sense of patriotism and duty that was used to manufacture consent for war. On October 7, 2001, the United States began its invasion of Afghanistan, along with several other coalition countries, and Operation Enduring Freedom. While the invasion targeted Al-Qaeda for the September 11th attacks, it also targeted the Taliban, which had nothing to do with 9/11. This, along with the shift in U.S. focus to Iraq throughout 2002 and 2003, caused the bungling of the effort to capture Osama bin Laden and destroy Al-Qaeda, and caused the war in Afghanistan to last nearly 20 years until U.S. forces withdrew in 2021, of course, as we know, under President Biden, and Afghanistan fell back into Taliban hands. However, even before the invasion of Afghanistan, the United States was not only trying to implicate Iraqi involvement, however possible, but was also drawing up plans for a great imperialist campaign throughout the Middle East to topple regimes and extend U.S. military or U.S. hegemony in the region. And just real quick, we'll watch a video. This is from, I believe, 2002 or 2003, of General Wesley Clark from the Bush administration talking about how they were going to take out seven countries in 5 years.
Right after 9/11, about 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, no. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." I said, "Is it classified?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Well, don't show it to me."
All right. So you see how we were planning a pretty big war on terror throughout the Middle East. So manufacturing consent before the Iraq War. Into 2002 and 2003, the United States and its corporate media spent millions of dollars and wasted no time in trying to convince the American public and the international community of the need to militarily intervene in Iraq based off accusations of Iraq having weapons of mass destruction, or WMDs. MSNBC, CNN, and Fox had on over 75 retired generals and officers who repeated Pentagon talking points to boost the propaganda for war. Meanwhile, shows such as Phil Donahue were removed from air for criticizing the rush to war. In February of 2003, Colin Powell, who was then Secretary of State under George W. Bush, went to the United Nations Security Council and presented false and faulty intelligence, including a vial of supposed anthrax, which it was just white powder, but it was meant to make a statement and make the argument for U.S. intervention in Iraq. And then we have the 2003 invasion of Iraq. In March of 2003, despite widespread global protests and skepticism about the intelligence regarding WMDs, the coalition illegally launched a preemptive invasion of Iraq. The initial military campaign was swift, leading to the capture of Baghdad in April 2003. However, the expected WMDs were not found, and the war evolved into a protracted and complex insurgency, contributing to the long-term instability in Iraq and shaping the geopolitical landscape of the Middle East for years to come. In the first few years of the conflict, U.S. atrocities at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq were uncovered. I believe they were revealed by Seymour Hersh. It was one of the things that he exposed. And also, U.S. forces found themselves in incredibly bloody battles in Fallujah, Abu Ghraib, Najaf, Samarra, and Mosul. American forces captured Saddam Hussein in 2003, brought him to the U.S. for medical treatment, and was sent back to Iraq to be sentenced to execution by hanging by the U.S.-backed government in Iraq. And of course, that didn't help when it came to all the resentment in that area. And with that, we'll go ahead and go to discussion.
I just want to make a quick comment, especially when you mentioned the Highway of Death. I do find it funny how even a lot of these events in popular media are kind of papered over or attributed to someone else. For example, one of the newer, I forget which one, but one of the newer Call of Duty games actually had a reference to the Highway of Death, but then said it was the Russians that did it. So I thought that was kind of interesting, yet kind of sad, funny at the same time.
Yeah, the first part of their campaign in 1990, in Desert Storm, was called Shock and Awe. They worked with the media to make sure that they showed the bombs exploding. They wanted to shock and awe. That's what they want the people of Iraq. They wanted to bomb them into submission, and they pretty much did. And that was Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, where the you play as the Russians and you kill a bunch of people in the Highway of Death, or they blame it on the Russians or whatever. But that's like everything that happens nowadays. Every time something blows up in Russia, they blame it on the Russians.
I was going to bring up Afghanistan and how the socialist government of Afghanistan, as we know, was overthrown. It was originally a operation from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union fell, and America and the CIA had their hands in Afghanistan from the very beginning. They were delighted that they got to, you know, work to kill communists. And when the socialist revolution was overthrown, who came in? It was all kinds of different war bosses, and they were fundamentalists, and they were funded by America, including those of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And yes, the Taliban didn't really always get along with Al-Qaeda and whatnot, but they... Really, a lot of the funding came from through Pakistan, which was going from the U.S. Like, there's a really good podcast. I know I've mentioned this before, called Blowback, and their current season is all about it's. It really is good, and they even bring up the early connections during the times of socialism of America working with Chinese groups or like Maoist groups to. Funnel money to lead to the more extremists in the parties that are anti-Soviet Union. But yeah, we really should bring up Afghanistan into this because I think it's a big factor in a lot of this. But I don't want to take up more time.
Just want to say legally, this is speculation, but I think an ulterior motive for Afghanistan was to get some, you know, U.S. military hardware close to China. But anyone can dig in on that.
Okay, I just wanted to touch on something with Iraq in 2003. So one of the first moves by the coalition forces was to ban the Iraqi Ba'ath Party, which employed about 50% of the adult population in Iraq. So, you know, do the math. This is basically going to make them all go to the streets. And when you're on the streets and there's forces there that have guns and have a way to fight the United States and all of this, it's pretty dark and twisted. But, you know, I'm pretty sure that the U.S. officials were definitely aware of this and used that to their benefit.
Al-Qaeda and the Taliban both came from the Mujahideen that was funded by the U.S., as we learned about in a prior U.S. imperialism class when they were fighting the socialist government of Afghanistan. But what a lot of people don't realize is when we went into Iraq and basically took the place over and we were working with a group called the Northern Alliance, that was another group that had broke away from the Mujahideen, and that we were another extremist group that we had funded in that period as part of the Mujahideen.
I could probably talk about this section of history all night, but I'll try to keep it short. I just wanted to comment on the false patriotism of the time that we went through during the Second Iraq War. And part of it, and this is due because I also happened to listen to the first season of Blowback, which is all about the Iraq War. I would also recommend it. But also from living through the time is we really wanted a good war. We really wanted a war that felt like what we think World War II was like. And we wanted, and especially like journalists felt a sort of guilt over how the Vietnam War happened. So it was easier to basically crush dissent, and anybody who spoke out against the war, we acted like it was World War II and that people were going to give room for, like, we are fighting Nazis, essentially. And it was just crap. But I also just wanted to say that, you know, we sent a lot of people over there who I think to say that it was false patriotism might be a stretch, because there were a lot of true people who went to Iraq because they were going to go wherever, and who were true patriots and went and fought and died for this country. So I think calling it false patriotism might be a little false in a certain sense. But we can't disown the armed forces who fought over there, because they were in their, there is a good part of that. It's just, we have to analyze it from a better perspective, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Thank you.
Yeah, just two brief corrections, and then I have a comment real quick. The first is, I think the game that depicts that Highway of Death thing and says that it's the Russians is the new modern warfare reboot, which that whole game is a Russian killing simulator, and its sequel is an Iranian killing simulator where you literally kill Qasem Soleimani at the beginning of the game. It has you do it yourself. And then I don't remember what the other correction was. Oh, the other correction was that Shock and Awe was actually from the second Iraq War, but in both of those Iraq wars, it was like they showed the best footage that made the U.S. military look the coolest, instead of like Vietnam War, where you had war journalists on the ground showing you really hard-hitting stuff that really brought up moral questions. But what I wanted to say is, just real quick, on 9/11 itself, you know, in the United States, whether it be in the left or in the right, you have people that have big conspiracy theories about 9/11 and whether it was an inside job and, oh, the Seventh World Trade Center, how did it fall? I don't think we have to make it that deep. I don't think that it has to be that, you know, much of a conspiracy. Al-Qaeda was a force that we propped up in the 1980s through the Mujahideen, and our actions resulted in them attacking us on 9/11. We did know about it before the attack. We did get tips that there was going to be there were these people that had came from the Middle East that were learning to fly airplanes, but didn't have any interest in learning how to land. And we basically just blew off all the tips about it and let it happen because we knew that we could use it to kick off this whole period of war. So I just wanted to say that 9/11, I don't think it was an inside job, but we definitely used it.
Yeah, I don't remember if it was in the slides or not, but you know, we showed Colin Powell there with the vial of Anaphylax. I'm promoting that. We can't forget about the anthrax scare we had in the U.S. at that time. And at this point, we didn't have any details on where, you know, who was responsible for it, and they used that to blame Iraq. But it later on came out that it came from a U.S. government contractor out of the Fort Detrick that came from the Fort Detrick stash. So this is just more ways in which we prop up the drive to war. Thanks.
Yeah, it's important to note that Osama, from the get-go, he's not Afghani. He was a Saudi. He comes from a Saudi, well-connected Saudi family that heads the major construction company, Bin Laden Construction. They have the monopoly on construction in Saudi Arabia. Family's still around. He was actually business partners with the Bush family, funny enough, before 9/11. He was our guy in Afghanistan. He was the counter gang, basically an agent and an asset of U.S. imperialism that the U.S. imperialists sent to Afghanistan to help destabilize the socialist government there called the People's Democratic Republic. We never really, in a sense, you know, this may sound odd, comrades, but we never really fought a war on terror. We fought a war expanding terror. The people who attacked us on 9/11, Al-Qaeda, they were our asset. They were the assets of the U.S. regime. These were the people that we used to fight against socialist Syria, Iraq, Libya. And if we were actually fighting a war on terror, we wouldn't even have had to invade Afghanistan to get bin Laden. The Taliban were willing to actually trade bin Laden, but we went in and invaded the country anyway to help get control of the opium fields, to help control the international drug trade. Which is another subject that we, as communists, we need to expose more, in my opinion. We never really fought a war on terror. We fought a war on the people who were fighting the terror. The Ba'athists were fighting terrorism. Gaddafi was fighting against terrorism. And we aimed the war on terror against all the anti-imperialist socialist countries in the Middle East. And it's just brought more havoc to this day.
Yeah, I think the comrade just mentioned Gaddafi. I think it was actually Gaddafi who was the first one to mention the threats of Osama. He, you know, in Libya, they had, I guess, a pseudo socialist country, but the Islamists that Osama was supporting was, you know, trying to cause a lot of problems there, and no one wanted to listen to Gaddafi, obviously. And we saw what we did with him, and also what we did with Saddam Hussein as well. We were supporting Iraq and Saddam against Iran as they overthrew the Shah. And so there seems to be a very obvious pattern that I'm sure we're quite aware of, that you just can't trust America. You see how that's going. And Colin Powell, you know, the guy who said, oh, we're running out of enemies, we're running out of villains. I'm left with Kim Jong Il and Castro. So you see where we went. We went to go fight terrorism because I guess all the communists were gone. So we had to fight something. That's all.
So when you, in that speech that General Wesley Clark gave, the last country on the list, he said, finishing off Iran. It's no coincidence that Iran is the last country on the list, because they basically, the imperialists save the best for last. And it's their ultimate dream to get into a war with Iran. Why? Because Iran is the biggest financial backer of groups in the Middle East. I mean, across Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. Basically, Iran is the one that's financing a lot of it. And yeah, I just wanted to bring that up. They save the best for last. It's no coincidence that Iran is number seven on the list. So I just wanted to say that.
Also, yeah, Iraq's been the dream of chicken hawks like John Bolton, John McCain, Netanyahu. That's been their dream for decades.
All right, so this is the last section for tonight, and I'll go ahead and read it. So first, with the World Trade Organization, the Uruguayan round of the Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is GATT and NAFTA. So the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and the 1993 Uruguayan round of the Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, which represent attempts to circumvent the sovereignty of nation states in favor of transnational corporations, were both founded around that time. The GATT agreements create a World Trade Organization, the WTO, which is an international association of over 120 signatory nations with the same legal status as the United Nations. And that's from Against Empire by Michael Pareny. And you can see over here, World Trade Organization members duly represented by the EU, observers, non-participant states like the DPRK is a non-participant and non-applicable. Then you have another section on this. Through GATT, the World Trade Organization was formed, which has the authority to prevent, overrule, or dilute the environmental, social, consumer, and labor laws of any nation. It sets up panels composed of non-elected trade specialists who act as judges over economic issues, placing them beyond the reach of national sovereignty, popular control, by surrendering that community interests will be subordinated to finance capital, also circumvented the sovereign power of the nation states themselves, bestowing upon unelected secret international tribunals the right to set standards for investments, thereby circumventing popular sovereignty. You can see the picture up in the corner that says free. It's a free trade table, and it says, "All right, now, who wants to work the cheapest?" So that was on the sort of financial institutions and agreements made around that age. Now, to talk about some government repression post 9/11 that we had to deal with domestically, the Patriot Act. So the USA Patriot Act, which the whole acronym actually spells out something, even USA, it's not United States. It's like, I forget what it is, but it's a very long acronym. It was signed into law in October of 2001 and was a sweeping piece of legislation allegedly aimed at enhancing the US government's ability to combat terrorism in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. However, the act granted law enforcement agencies increased surveillance and intelligence gathering powers, allowing for the monitoring of communications, access to business records, the expansion of information sharing between agencies. And while the proponents argued that these measures were crucial for national security, the Patriot Act had a significant negative impact on American civil rights and liberties. It was an abuse of surveillance powers, as well as the corrosion of privacy rights due to the broad and often vague language used in the legislation. The act enabled warrantless searches and wiretapping, infringing on the Fourth Amendment, and disproportionately targeting specific communities, leading to a broader debate on the delicate balance between security measures and the preservation of individual freedoms. Currently, the act remains expired, but was renewed for years under Democrat and Republican presidencies and House majorities. Then we have the Homeland Security Act of 2002, protecting the so-called idea of the homeland. The Homeland Security Act of 2002 was enacted in response to the 9/11 attacks and aimed to establish a Department of Homeland Security, DHS, consolidating various federal agencies responsible for protecting the United States from terrorist threats. It negatively impacted American civil rights and liberties as the act expanded the government's surveillance capabilities and granted broad authority to DHS, raising concerns about potential abuses of power and the erosion of privacy rights. Furthermore, the legislation had significant implications for immigrants, as it led to increased scrutiny and stricter immigration policies. Measures like the creation of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, ICE, and intensified border security contributed to the targeting of immigrant communities, which led to gross abuses of migrants and to the Obama and Trump administrations. It also introduced a temporary color-coded Homeland Security Advisory System, which induced fear in the American people over threats of terrorism and kept them supportive of the war of terror on that basis. And lastly, the Transportation Security Administration, tightening security on everyone. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the Transportation Security Administration implemented extensive security measures at airports across the United States to prevent similar incidents and enhance aviation safety. These measures included stringent security screenings, the introduction of full body scanners, and the implementation of thorough baggage checks. While the heightened security was aimed at ensuring passenger safety, it also led to negative consequences for Americans traveling through airports during the 2000s. Passengers experienced longer lines, increased wait times, enhanced scrutiny, as well as increased levels of sexual assault at airports. The measures veered into invasions of privacy, with concerns raised about the effectiveness and necessity of certain screening methods. Additionally, the implementation of these security measures sparked debates about striking the right balance between protecting national security and preserving the convenience and civil liberties of air travelers. The airport security landscape evolved significantly, leaving a lasting impact on the travel experience for Americans during this period. And with that, we can go to the last round of discussion.
I did us all the favor of looking up what USA Patriot Act stands for, because I'd never heard of this. It stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Interpret or Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism.
The government loves their acronyms. They love their acronyms.
Thank you, comrade. With regard to the last round of discussions and Cameron's point about 9/11 and the bourgeois ignoring intelligence to justify invasions, it strikes an eerily similar tone to October 7th of last year. And in regards to the TSA, they are horrifically bad at their jobs. They frequently fail to detect dummy packages that are, supposed to be explosives, weapons, or illegal drugs. They fail to find those. And it's mostly just security theater to make people feel secure. They don't actually do the job they claim to be doing.
Yes. If anyone has had the opportunity to travel internationally, you'll notice that most, well, at least the countries that I've been in, it's not that strict. I remember getting prepared for going through customs or whatnot in Japan, and I would take off my belt, take off my shoes, take off everything, and everyone would look at me like I was a crazy man. But I was just used to the American way, which is kind of a weird thing to think that this is the American way now. And I just wanted to mention, like, when doing the research for all of this, it's still kind of like the Wild West, I guess, of Marxism-Leninism. This kind of era, because we don't have the party like we used to back in the 70s and the 80s, where I like when at least for me, where I could look at like Jewish Life or Comrade Henry Winston's work or Gus Hall's, or going back to Lenin or Stalin or anything. So, you know, I just wanted to bring up, this is probably something we can work on, creating like the Marxist-Leninist lens for a lot of this work. But I think what was brought to me was new North Star Compass magazine, which is like the U.S. Friends of Soviet Peoples in Canada, and a lot of Michael Prentice's work. It's just been helpful. And that Blowback podcast. That's all.
Yeah, one of the things I also wanted to point out about this period is the American relationship with Russia during this time. Because initially, as we know, Putin came to multiple U.S. presidents multiple times asking to be let into NATO He came to Clinton, was promised so and denied, came to Bush, was denied. And, you know, initially in that time, they were trying to work with the Americans and create a stronger relationship, and even supported our initial intervention in Afghanistan after 9/11, because it was like, well, you guys were attacked, you have a right to respond. But when the war in Iraq came about, Russia decided, we're not going to follow you into this. This is just an imperialist drive that isn't necessary. Iraq didn't attack you. We're not going to support this. The U.S. turned around and implicated that Russia was supplying arms to Saddam Hussein at the time. It was like right as the war started that we were trying to say that Russia was militarily backing Iraq. And so that was like the big split between the United States and Russia at the time. And I think the point where Putin realized that he would have to prepare for some sort of confrontation at some point with the United States, if not just trying to understand the need for a multipolar world, which we would at least at some point see start to reemerge again. So, but I wanted to offer that. And then just real briefly, just on 9/11, you know, as Marxist-Leninists, we don't support terrorism. There are a lot of ultra-leftists out there that say that, oh, America got what they deserved that day. You know, it was something that America caused. And it was a result of our imperialism. It was blowback. What we did in the Middle East bit us in the ass, to be frank. But it was still an attack on mostly working-class Americans, and nobody deserves to die from terrorism. So I just wanted to add that.
You know me having to point out hypocrisies. Although China, for example, being a good example of a solid socialist country, sure, they have cameras and national security. But for all the rhetoric that the U.S. brings up about how controlling they are, I mean, look at this Patriot Act, right? They're watching you. And at least in China, you know you're on camera. You don't know when they're listening to you here. So just want to make sure that that's obviously stated, the hypocrisy. Thank you.
So in Chechnya, some of the same organizations from Afghanistan fought in Chechnya, and some of the organizations that we propped up, there were several groups. They're all generic. You can really tell when they're U.S. funded. They're really generic. They have just a plain black or white flag with Arabic on it, and they fight, you know, these wars on behalf of the United States, and they try to break it. They want to break up Russia. They want to balkanize it. They want some people call Russia a settler colonial state, and it deserves to break up. And that's ultra left thinking completely. And we shouldn't hope for the breakup of Russia, because it's a country that has potential. They have several. Stalin is becoming very popular again in Russia. A lot of people say that they rather live under socialism than what they have now. So we have to keep an eye on Russia. And they also help in anti-imperialist causes all the time. Like they help
60 seconds.
Iraq, Syria, and what they're doing now in the Donbass. So I don't think we can look at Russia as an imperialist country like the United States is.
Hey, thanks. I just want to recommend a good book on Iraq. It was written by former CIA senior analyst John Nixon, who was actually the first person who interrogated Saddam Hussein after the invasion of Iraq, after he was captured. It's called Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. And in it, you find out that Saddam Hussein was actually thought 9/11 would be good for him, that it would bring him closer to the U.S. again, because he's been fighting these extremist Islamic elements within Iraq for years. But as we all know, that didn't turn out that way. It's a great book. Check it out.
I don't know if what our formal stance is on the WTO, but I was just wondering about that, and whether we view it as something that's inherently reactionary as a concept, or more something that's redeemable in theory, if anyone has anything to say on that.
We never talked negatively about it, and we never talked positively about it. It was something from World War II. the United Nations and that kind of thing. That's all I know of it.
Yeah, I'm actually really glad that we included that section on trade, because I think sometimes we forget, you know, the roots of Lenin's imperialism, the highest age of capitalism, where he's essentially describing the economic strangling and the division of world markets and the fight for the control over that. And so I feel like sometimes we get a lot focused, because it is, it's horrifying, and it's very easy to look at like the wars and all the killings that have happened. But I feel like the real power of capitalism is its ability to strip the sovereignty of other nations through economic policy and the control of their resources. And so, you know, I just wanted to add that in there, which is the reason why, I guess, in the answer to the WTO question, perhaps it could be reformed, but you would need a revolution to do so, since we are kind of the primary controlling force of the WTO at the moment. Thanks.
As I was mentioned in those slides, the GATT of 93 is what formed the WTO. And this is really, you know, also the fall of the Soviet Union or the counter-revolution. And you really didn't get much from, I would say, communist China against this, and the rest of the world as well. Even Cuba had some reforms that I think were not good, but you see as we mentioned, a unipolarity, and like in the time of Lenin, it wasn't such a unipolarity of imperialism. You had a breakaway of, you know, German imperialism and British and American imperialism, like even America and Britain fought over what is now, which was the mandated Palestine and Israel and Palestine now. And you don't really have that disagreement under the World Trade Organization. And now we see what's happening today. You do have some, I would say, nationalistic states. I would argue that Iraq was kind of a, wasn't really beholden to Western capitalism, and they had to suffer because of that. But they definitely weren't communists either. And so I think it is reactionary, the World Trade Organization. And I'm just, you know, curious what people think compared to the days of Lenin, how imperialism has changed.
I forget if it's through the World Trade Organization or another, but there are a series of tribunals where all these trade agreements and laws go, where basically corporations can take nations to court over whatever free trade or other trade rules that have seemed to be broken. And these are kind of ways that some of these corporations keep a stranglehold on any country that tries to go against some of the trade policy that has propped up. And I'm just blanking on the name at the moment, though, unfortunately.
You may be thinking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which my understanding was going to be like the WTO on steroids. It was drafted by Obama and was supposed to be signed by his successor, but then Trump refused to pass it. But yeah, I was going to basically have like unaccountable tribunals. So if any state or country or even small business did something trade-wise in the Pacific region that, you know, the overlords didn't care for, then they would be subject to, you know, all sorts of repercussions, you know, the likes of which we would consider undemocratic, to say the least. Anyways, that's my general understanding of the TPP. Thanks.
Thank you. No, I know that was part of the TPP, but I think there was actually another organization. I'm trying to find it, if my freaking internet would work. I might have been thinking about the Court of International Trade, which was another district court, not in the normal district court systems, that basically goes over any cases involving international trade. But maybe I'm thinking of something else.
If there are no other hands, we will go to our wrap-up section now.
All right. And just real quick before we get to that, I want to say that this series has been really good so far. We have about two more Yeah, I think two more classes when it comes to this. One that goes over from 2005 to 2020. That'll be the height of American unipolarity. So that'll cover what happened in the late Bush administration and to the Obama and Trump administrations. And then after that will be like 2020 to present day, the fall of American unipolarity, you know, subsequent rise of multipolarity again. So we're almost to the end of this series, and I'm really happy that we've been able to do this because it's opened up a lot of discussions and we found out a lot of things that we didn't even know about when it comes to our own nation's actions around the world. I think the last song that we have tonight is Let Us Begin, What Are We Making Weapons For by John Denver from 1986. So we'll play that and then we'll go ahead and adjourn for tonight.
Thank you for watching this full-length class from the People's School for Marxist-Leninist Studies. For more information or to join our free classes, visit our website, check out our YouTube, listen to our streams on Spotify, and chat with us on Reddit.